Judgment seemed not so much an observation as an analysis. A fine one. Too fine for this time of rough animal realities and ugliness. Dear Benita, whose dreaminess and impracticality had been a reminder of all that was beautiful and light, she had always made Anya laugh. Was it the end of her affair with Herr Müller that had killed her? She had seemed so distraught on that day in the hospital. It would be like Benita to die for love. But Anya had no one to ask. In her solitary sadness, she hung pine branches and oranges pierced with cloves across their foyer, the way Benita had taught her. They lent the house an air of spicy sweetness. And when Anya walked beneath them with the baby, little Mary craned her neck to see these ordinary objects that bobbed and glimmered in the dark, made beautiful by their suspension. This morning, as Anya sits on the stone wall, the castle begins to stir with life. A man opens red sun umbrellas on a new attractive rooftop terrace. Someone tugs back curtains across the plate glass windows on the first floor. It is good to see the castle in its new life. It has become such a useful democratic place, housing all these well-meaning people from every corner of the world. They are trying to understand all sorts of complicated things. What makes humans cruel or kind, and how we might all live together in peace. Anya appreciates their efforts, although she is skeptical that they will ever find an answer. Hitler always said there were too many people on Earth. Too many people in Germany. Such a small country, so many people. But then, of course, it turned out his answer to this was not a solution, but a symptom of the disease. He was the rat in the maze that begins to eat the others. Anya is about to rise and head back toward the castle when she sees a form approaching. A woman, her hair blowing upward in the wind. Mary. Anya lifts her arms in a wave. Mary's hands are shoved deep inside the pockets of her jacket. Stiff-looking with a collar and a waxy rubberized sheen. An odd garment, designed for some specific circumstance but worn generally. Like those pants with all the pockets and loops and strings attached. Or the slick clothes Anya always associated with gymnastics that are now worn for anything that involves movement. Grown men ride bicycles in slippery, skin-tight garments. Anya is too old to understand such things. "Couldn't go back to sleep," Mary says when she is closer. "I miss the kids. The children. The idea of them belongs to another world. Another life." It takes Anya a moment to register her daughter's meaning. "They will survive," she says. "But of course you do." Mary sighs and sits on the wall beside her mother. "It's a beautiful view," she says. "I forgot how beautiful it is here. Is this part of the world?" Anya, too, has forgotten. Impulsively, she links her arm through Mary's. It is the sort of gesture she has not made since their fight. And to her relief, Mary gives it a squeeze. It brings tears to her eyes. "I don't deserve you," Anya says. "I did so many things wrong. I lived my life wrong. But you know now," Mary says, turning to her, "you take responsibility for your mistakes. You ask for forgiveness." Anya starts in such a way that she nearly falls. "Forgiveness? God forbid." She crosses herself, the gesture coming to her across the years. "I would never ask for that." Mary is quiet. "You admit," she says finally. "That counts for something."
"Does it?"
Anya asks.
"I think so," Mary says.
Anya would like to ask, in what sort of calculation? She can see it is important to Mary to believe this. She is an American, after all. She has been swept up in the culture of talk, of belief in psychotherapy and confession, of television shows in which people reclaim their innocence through voicing their regrets. In Anya's view, no talk in the world can change the past. If Mary knew about those babies, she would know that taking responsibility doesn't matter. It can't bring them back.
It can't return them to their lives, to their parents. And there is no atonement for all the lies Anya told herself instead of acting. That the babies were going to an orphanage, to foster families, or God knows what other acceptable end, even as she hung her head over the latrine and threw up. This is what Anya will pay for. Not only her inaction, but her self-deception. For narrating away evil while staring it in the face. How can she tell her daughter this? Instead, she squeezes Mary's arm and appreciates her kindness, her understanding. This is why people have children, even when they believe the world is going to hell, even when life is nothing but uncertainty, in hopes of being understood. Chapter 36. Berglingenfels, October 1991. Marianne sits at the desk in the strange visiting dignitary bedroom she has been assigned and tries to prepare her speech.
"Not a speech, just remarks," Claire corrected her. "Nothing too complicated."
She wonders whether Claire is nervous about what she will say. After all, the book is Claire's narrative, but the life is still hers. Before she left home, Marianne prepared some funny anecdotes from her time in the resistance. A few cautionary parables, a recognition of contemporary resistors around the world. But now what she wrote seems grandiose, full of overblown rhetoric. She and Anya spent hours talking in the library last night. Anya's life is three-dimensional now. No, not merely three-dimensional, but three-faced. Anya Fortzmann, Anya Brandt, Anya Grabarek. Why did Marianne never know of these? In her mind, these faces are no longer broken into good or bad, true or false. They have been laid bare, a collection of choices and circumstances.
"Why didn't you try to tell me all this after Rainer died?" Marianne asked her friend. "Why didn't you explain yourself?"
"Because you wouldn't have cared," Anya said.
"And you were right."
Marianne did not protest. She saw herself that day in the castle, standing in the kitchen doorway, staring at Anya and the dying man. She had not been interested in knowledge. It was too close to the war, to Albrecht's death, to all the deaths. Knowledge would have been too much to stomach. Benita's life also has become more whole to Marianne on this trip. Spending time with Martin brings his mother back. He is compelling in the same way Benita was. Not just his handsomeness, but something more intangible. His aura. The New Age word comes to Marianne's mind. Marianne has always scoffed at the idea of such vagaries. But here, against the backdrop of this ancient castle, in this last chapter of her life, the idea of an aura or an energy feels true and important. As real as action. The gold standard around which she has built her life. This is why people were drawn to Benita, why Connie fell in love with her. There is a light knock on the door, and before she turns, a child rushes in, followed by her son, Fritz.
"Omi,"
the little girl calls, her curly hair flying behind her in a wild mop. Nicola, Fritz's youngest, a little girl as exuberant and incautious as her father was as a child. Of all her grandchildren, Marianne loves her best.
"Nicola,"
Marianne exclaims.
"What a nice surprise. I brought her with me.
Angela is sick," Fritz explains, crossing the room and bending to kiss his mother. "She promised to be quiet. Isn't that right?" He turns to his daughter. "Quiet as a mouse during Omi's speech."
"Like a mouse,"
Nicola proclaims, scrunching her face into an approximation of mouseness, and tiptoeing delightedly around the room.
"Oh, be however you want,"
Marianne says, wishing there were no speech, and no party to attend.
"Aha, here it is,"
Fritz exclaims, catching sight of the hardcover lying on the desk beside her.
"Do I finally get a copy of the book about my famous mother?"
He lifts it and begins reading the back, which is full of airy quotes from academics and journalists. For a moment,
In his concentration, he reminds her of Albrecht, tall, slightly stoop-shouldered, holding the book at arm's length.
Oh, Fritzl,
Marianne says, reverting to his childhood nickname.
I am your mother. You don't need that book.
Marianne goes downstairs to the reception in a combination of panic and mental haze. The visit from Fritz and Nicolas has kept her from any further preparing of what she would like to say, though she suspects it was not going to come clear anyway. Despite Alice's entreaties, Marianne has not changed her clothes. She wears her beige cardigan and pleated khakis, a pair of horrible, comfortable walking shoes. It doesn't matter. Of this much she is certain, at least. When she enters the room, she is startled to see so many people. There must be 200 in attendance. Fellows, academics from Humboldt and the Free University, contacts of Claire's and the director's. And then, dear God, she has almost forgotten those she invited herself. Old Eberhard von Strahlen and his middle-aged daughter, Irmgard Teitelmann, Mamie Kaltenbrunner, Peter Weber. They have come all the way from Hamburg. Old long-lost friends. And is that one of the von Oberth's children? Now a middle-aged man? She recognizes the distinctive forward-jutting chin.
There you are,
Martin says, appearing beside her to take her elbow and steer her toward her seat. He does not seem fazed by her appearance. His aura may resemble his mother's, but his manners and charm are all Connie Fledermann. Marianne reaches up and pats his hand. When she is settled, the director rises and moves to the podium.
I am so proud to be here, to be part of this celebration of an important book by a past fellow of the Falkenberg Institute. A book that examines the very essence of resistance and moral clarity. What does it take for a person to be able to recognize evil as it unfolds? To see with foresight and acuity.
Marianne listens uncomfortably. When he finishes, Claire rises and takes the stage. She looks more serious today, in a black dress and funny dark-rimmed glasses, a string of bright red Chinese beads around her neck.
It has been my great good fortune to be a transcriber to this marvelous and heroic woman, a woman whose courage and moral backbone stayed stick straight in a time when most others bent. A woman in a world whose intellectual and political circles were dominated by men.
The words make Marianne squirm. She thinks of all those in the audience, whom she has known in so many different places and at so many different crossroads of her life. Certainly, she has not always been so infallible.
I would like to invite Marianne forward to offer a few words, Claire says.
For a long moment, and with a sense of growing panic, Marianne remains frozen in her seat. But then, Martin is standing before her, offering his arm. He has come all the way from America to Berglingenfels at her request. She allows him to lead her up to the podium. The audience looks at her expectantly. And as Marianne stares back, more faces become clear. A von Kreisberg cousin whose name she can't remember, but whose mother hosted her and the children on their flight from Wieslau. And there, beside him, the kind librarian from the document center. And standing against the wall, two childhood girlfriends of Elisabeth's.
When will she talk?
Nicola's 4-year-old voice says from the back of the room, where Fritz holds her in his arms. A few audience members laugh. Marianne takes a deep breath. She must say something, but an apology is all that comes to mind. She is not sure for what.
You would think,
she says finally, and her voice sounds foreign to her own ears.
You would think from this introduction that I must be a very wonderful person.
There is more laughter. The audience is relieved that she has opened her mouth.
And that I must have answers and secrets of how to be good, and how to see evil and resist it, and everything else Claire said.
Outside, a crow squawks from the parapet.
Instead, Marianne continues, I look out at you and I see so many familiar faces, so many people I have known
and not known. So many people I have lost. And I see, most of all, my own blind spots.
The audience is very quiet. In the front row, Claire looks anxious. And as Marianne stands, gripping the podium, her eyes find Anya, sitting in the front row, between her daughter and Martin.
She is so small, such a tiny person. How is it that in all those years Marianne never noticed this? And her face, her dear face, so deeply lined and etched with grooves and wrinkles, the bed of a violent river.
Anya returns her gaze, and as the silence grows, she nods, ever so slightly, as if to say,
"Go on, continue. I am here, no matter what you say."
A memory rises in Marianne's mind. That night, so many years ago, when she and Anya waited together while the Russians feasted. The dark, uneasy quiet of the castle, the flickering shadows of the fire, and outside, the suspended carcass of Gilda's body. She can hear the crackle of sparks and the strange sounds of the men's voices, gathering into a low and otherworldly song. How grateful she had been to have Anya beside her. A fellow adult and human being, connected not through allegiance to any group or party or particular way of thinking, but through the reality of the moment, through their shared will to get through the next hours, the next day, and the one afterward, and through their shared determination to keep their children safe. It is the great regret of her life that she lost this. No, that she forsook it, and that she lost Benita, too. Her sweet, flawed friend, fellow widow and human being, whom Marianne can see now that she, in her own way, betrayed.
"I want to say," she begins again, "I want to say that I have not always tried hard enough to know, that this moral compass Claire talks about may not have been as helpful in my own personal life as it was in the wider political context. Sometimes it is easier to see clearly from a distance. And what is up close,"
she falters,
"is harder to make out."
In the audience, someone coughs.
"There is so much gray between the black and the white. And this is where most of us live. Trying..."
Marianne loses her place. "Trying what?" Confusion presses in on her. Not just of the moment, the words, but the greater confusion of life itself. The whole murky, impulsive side of human interaction, the tangled knots of influence and emotion. A vast, primordial soup she has spent her life trying to negate.
"Trying, but so often failing to bend towards the light."
Marianne can feel her tongue dry in her mouth. The world grows dim, and there is an odd buzzing sound. She meets the eyes of the Chinese scholar she was introduced to last night.
What does she know of him?
Of his experience? The world is too vast to know in all its corners. Then, all at once, her knees give out. Her vision goes before her consciousness. But she can feel, suddenly, a strong pair of arms catching her, holding her up.
"I'm sorry,"
she says, or tries to say.
"Shh."
She recognizes Martin's voice.
"We need our heroes. No more apologies."
Then all is quiet. Chapter 37. Berglingenfels, October 1991. Martin wakes in bed next to Mary. He can't think of her as Marianne, which is what she would like to be called. Mary, it turns out, is a nickname she has always disliked. Last night, when Marianne revived, the castle was filled with jubilant relief. Thank God! Imagine if she had died right there on the castle floor, killed by the effort of straying beyond the clarity that has defined her life. When her eyes opened, even stoic Anya wept with relief. And the party that followed was a real bash. The Sophie Scholl scholar played the fiddle, and a Russian philosopher taught a group of guests to dance the barnya. And the food was excellent. Delicate white trout, new potatoes and homegrown carrots from the castle's kitchen garden, now a vast organic nursery. For dessert, Martin's favorite, fluffy shredded pancakes known as Kaiserschmarrn, a local specialty, and of course, lots of champagne. Mary and Martin were among the last guests to depart. Mary is not the sort of woman Martin usually pursues. She is a little scattered and too modern, really. He is generally drawn to cool, steady women with unruffleable feathers. But there is, underneath her disorganized charm, a kind of emotional steadiness. And she has a good sense of humor, which is a surprise coming from the daughter of Anya and Karsten Kellermann, whom Martin remembers as a German version of American Gothic. Though, apparently, what did he know? Mary shared her mother's revelations with him last night. A secret past. A Nazi husband still alive when she married Karsten. It is to Marianne's credit, Martin supposes, that she never told him any of this. It is possible that in his usual sidestepping way, he never really asked her why she and Anya fell so completely out of touch. Like many members of his generation, he has made a career of avoiding difficult questions.
Can you imagine?
Mary asked as they lay side by side.
My mother was nursing one husband by day and sleeping with another at night.
No, Martin agreed, he couldn't. But this was at the bottom of the list of things he can't imagine. Auschwitz, Treblinka, believing in Hitler, the mother of a fatherless boy committing suicide. And there are actually whole swaths of his own experience that he can't imagine. Living in an orphanage for children of traitors, spending nights in bomb shelters, reclaiming his mother from some rat's nest of Russian soldiers. Anyway, he likes Mary, and he feels connected to her through this place. They are both products of the same mess. He runs a finger down her brow and nose, coming to rest on her lips. Her eyes fly open, and her look of surprise makes him laugh.
Oh, my God, she says, sitting bolt upright. I hope my mother isn't awake yet.
You make me feel so young, Martin laughs. I haven't worried about anyone's mother since I was 17.
Ha! Huh.
Mary fumbles with the sheet, tucking it awkwardly around her body, stripping it from him as she stands.
Sorry,
she blushes. But Martin is too old to be ashamed of his nakedness.
Here.
He hands her a pair of gold hoop earrings from beside the bed.
You look as though you do this every day, she says. Sleep with a weirdly connected stranger in a castle where you spent a traumatic childhood, she clarifies.
Not every day.
Every other,
Mary says, smiling. And looking at her, this middle-aged American daughter of Karsten and Anya's, standing naked on the ancient stone floor of Burg Lingenfels, Martin is filled with an unfamiliar, buoyant happiness. There is a farewell breakfast this morning in the Great Hall, after which the guests will disperse. Mary to drive Anya the 2 hours back to her retirement home on Lake Constance.
Can you persuade her to move to America to live near me?
She had begged Martin last night. Marianne to the hospital in Munich for tests. The woman has the constitution of an ox, but her fainting spell should be fully evaluated, Fritz and Martin together insisted. Martin himself will go north, first to Frühlinghausen to visit his mother's grave and his aunt Gertrude, the one member of Benita's family with whom he is still in touch. After Frühlinghausen, he has one more stop, to visit Liesl Falkman, his long-lost friend. For years as a boy, he dreamed of her, though he never spoke of this. And then, before coming here, he tracked her down and wrote to her, and she wrote back. Of course she remembers him, although she tries not to think about that time much. She spent the rest of her childhood, such as it was, living with her aunt in the flat where he and Marianne had left her, in a part of Berlin that ended up behind the wall, in the east. Now that Germany is one again, she has moved to Hamburg. She is an accountant with 2 grown children, long since divorced. At first, he was dismayed by these details.
What did this ordinary life have to do with the fierce, intelligent Liesl of his youth?
but he has bucked his tendency to avoid possible disappointment and booked his return flight out of Hamburg. He has made a reservation at the Hotel Atlantic for them to have lunch. On his way down to the breakfast, Martin pauses on the landing. The Sophie Scholl scholar and Russian philosopher are listening to Claire, who is waving her arms, holding forth, and Mary, who has beaten him downstairs, sits with her mother talking to Fritz. There is warmth between them, and Anya looks happy, or as happy as she can with her tragic face. Marianne presides from the wheelchair she has been relegated to, while her granddaughter scrambles around on her lap. She looks smaller than usual, and tired. Some spark of righteousness has been extinguished. But all the same, from her seat at the center, she emanates Marianne-ness. The great hall itself is just as Martin remembers it from childhood. Cavernous, dim, and chilly. And standing here, he feels the chafing layers of time. The inscrutable ghost of himself as a little boy, colliding with the shifty construct of himself as a middle-aged man. And all around, he feels the press of other lesser-known ghosts. Marianne as a young woman, his mother as a bride-to-be, the Nazi occupiers with their shiny leather boots, the harvest party's ill-fated Jewish guests, the frightened townspeople hiding from the Americans, centuries of gouty princes and counts and long-suffering servants. They all seem to be climbing these steps, and their movements have an urgent restlessness. Through this, Martin hears Marianne's voice. "Here he is," she is saying. "My favorite guest." Martin looks around. "Martin Fledermann," she says, as if they are the only two people in the hall. He feels the force of her love for him, and it makes him proud. Smiling back, he approaches, holding out his hand. Chapter 38. Berglingenfels, 1991. Clotilde Müller likes to walk her dogs on the grounds of the Falkenberg Institute. Not only because it is beautiful, but because it makes her feel close to her father now that he is dead. She can imagine him hacking away at the thicket of trees in the once unruly woods, now a carefully maintained park crisscrossed by well-signed gravel paths. She had been coming here for years before she learned of the time her father had spent at the castle chopping wood. To be fair, Clotilde did not ask him many questions. She is a woman of few words, and Franz Müller was a man of even fewer. All a question gets is an answer. And in her experience, you don't always want those. As a gardener, she knows that if you turn over a rock, you will find worms and potato bugs, sometimes even a snake. And as a German, she knows that if you start poking through a shoebox of photographs, you'll find Nazi uniforms and swastikas, and children with their arms raised in Heil Hitler salutes. And then what? Does that help you love the cranky old father whose laundry and dentures and toilet bowl you have to clean? To treasure the grandparent whose dementia already tests your patience? Clotilde knows she was lucky in this regard. Her father was kind and mild-mannered and easy to get along with until the end. And his silence was a gift. Even when he broke this, it was not to unburden himself. It was to provide her with the facts, which, after all their years living together, she never knew, because she never asked. So, he had been drafted into the reserve police and sent to the East late in the war, assigned to load Jews and Slavs and other undesirables onto Treblinka-bound trucks.
"Did you know where they were going?"
Clotilde asked. He hesitated. "Not in the beginning, but then, yes." And once he knew, he asked to be transferred to another, less intensive detail, and they granted his request. He became, instead, a courier of documents, shuttling sealed envelopes between army groups.
"It was that easy?" Clotilde asked.
"You just had to ask to be transferred, and they did it."
He was silent for some time, his meaty hands spread on top of the hospital sheet. Yes, he said finally, at least in my case. But he felt at the time that he had been selfish asking for this special treatment, that it meant someone else in his unit had to do the job of sending women and children to their deaths. So his resistance was not out of moral clarity, but out of a selfish cowardice.
What nonsense, Clotilde said. It is the right thing. The question is, why didn't everyone else? Don't belittle it.
But her father did not concede. He looked out the hospital window, and after that day, they never spoke of it. There was a time when Clotilde imagined a different life for herself. One with a husband and children and her own home, maybe somewhere else. But her father was an easy man to live with, and a surprisingly good cook. She has a job she loves as a gardener in the town park, and she has her dogs. And based on what she understands of history and sees of the present, dogs are a superior species. Clotilde remembers Berglingenfels as it was when she was a teenager. Abandoned, graffitied, its windows broken and weeds pushing through its ancient stones. Frau von Lingenfels, the woman who owned it, had moved to the United States, and in her absence it became a haven for vagrants and local teenagers up to no good. Clotilde was lured there one night by a migrant farm worker, for an experience she doesn't care to remember, certainly nothing the castle hadn't seen before. After that, she stayed away. But now the castle is grand once again, inhabited by intellectuals from all over the world. The Falkenberg Institute proclaims itself to be a site of moral inquiry. Fellows come here to ask questions. Well, leave them to it. Clotilde comes here not to inquire, but to follow her father's wishes. There is a grave in the forest behind the castle that he asked her to visit, a body he buried with his own hands. Franz Müller didn't know much about the man. He was a Russian prisoner, released from the local Stalag after the war. He had arrived at Berglingenfels with a band of fellow former prisoners, all hungry, weak, and diseased. And in these woods, he had come across her father. There was an altercation, and there was a woman present, a woman with whom her father had been in love. This is the difficult part, because Clotilde remembers this woman. She was beautiful, with light eyes and pale hair. She was introduced to Clotilde as her father's future bride, and Clotilde, as an 11-year-old, had concocted a wealth of lovely fantasies around her. This woman who would become her mother and teach her to sew and buy underwear and other embarrassing girl items, maybe even give her a little brother or sister so she would no longer be alone. But then, poof, the woman disappeared. No marriage, no courtship, no further mention of her. It was one of the great disappointments of Clotilde's young life. Anyway, this woman, Benita Fledermann was her name, somehow came across Clotilde's father and this Russian, and something happened. The man attacked her, or she attacked him, and the man was killed.
Who killed him?
Clotilde had asked her father, who nodded solemnly. But he had never been a good liar.
Or she killed him,
Clotilde had pressed. It doesn't matter, he answered. We killed him. This was a crime punishable by death. The murder of a former enemy combatant. A violation of the ceasefire. So Franz buried the man. And the time being what it was, no one came looking. No one even noticed he was gone. But the man lay on Franz Müller's conscience, as much as any of the victims he felt responsible for in the East. He had carved a small cross on the tree above the grave, and he visited once a month. He cleared the nastiest weeds and brought flowers, and most of all, stood there and listened to the forest and tried to show respect. At some point, her father had researched the man at the local archive, and discovered an article in the town paper from around that time. More of a newsletter, really, released by the occupying Americans, naming a Fyodor Ivanov, former inmate of Stalag 7A, missing, last seen outside of Arenheim with his former Stalag comrades. It was one of many such listings. Missing persons took up a whole page, and Franz had not known how to pursue it further. He had only a grade school education. He was not a researcher, and Ivanov was a common Russian name. Some years ago, another body was discovered in these same woods. This was right before Franz Müller died, and he had followed the story with interest. The bones were entered into an official process run by the German office, the state agency responsible for such findings. They were analyzed and bundled into black plastic, stored temporarily in the town's morgue. DNA testing revealed they belonged to a German male, approximately 38 years old, with evidence of combat injuries and death from a wasting sickness. No definitive identity was established. The bones were reinterred in a cardboard box in the Arenheim Cemetery. Were the bones of that man, whoever he was, any better off now than they were before they were found? This was the question Franz Müller asked. He honestly didn't know. Clotilde could decide, once he was gone, what she should do. Her father's secret is now her responsibility. She is still undecided. Maybe someday she will go to the authorities and set the official exhuming process in motion. Maybe they will dig up the bones and discover enough information to separate this specific Fyodor Ivanov from all the others declared dead or missing at the time. Maybe his family will be tracked to some corner of what is now Belarus and contacted by a tireless employee of the German office whose job it is to conduct this sort of post-mortem search. And maybe this will bring someone closure, or stir their anger, or reopen wounds. But it won't bring back the man. For now, Clotilde maintains her father's tradition. She visits the grave and ensures it is not entirely overgrown. She brings flowers from her garden, or sometimes a special stone she has found on a trip. The original cross Franz Müller carved into the trunk has grown up out of sight. And there is a new one. A stripe he gouged into the bark maybe 15 years ago, which itself has moved up. Any passers-by who might stumble upon the site would probably imagine it an animal's grave or a child's fairy house. Maybe they would stop and wonder for a moment, but most probably not. When she visits, Clotilde follows her father's instructions. In the dappled light beneath the tall pine, she tries to think of the varied beauties of life. The watchful way her dogs look on as she stands in silence. The sight of crocus heads pushing through the melting snow. The fact that human beings are compelled to construct cathedrals and sing lullabies and create art. That they devote themselves to obscure causes and esoteric fields of knowledge. That the world population grows by 80 million people each year. She conjures these things in her mind and hopes they have meaning. And she doesn't say a word. This is Cassandra Campbell. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Women in the Castle by Jessica Shattuck. This program was produced by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2017 by Jessica Shattuck. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.